Judge not, that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye mete, it shall be measured to you again. Hello and welcome back to Cover to Cover. Today we're talking about a play that I have always loved. It's Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. What a play! A world of city streets, whorehouses, prisons, judges, pimps, people in disguise, people often in disguise from themselves. A tremendous gallery of characters. Pompey the Bored, who works with Mistress Overdone and her flotilla of prostitutes, and who is just trying to get by. As he says, "I am a poor fellow that would live." He's trying to get by in a world subject to coronavirus, to recession, political upheaval, and the threat of war. Then there's Elbo the Constable, who confuses the word benefactor with the word malefactor, the verb respect with the verb disrespect, who is very much out at elbow. There's the very frothy gentleman, Master Froth. There's Lucio, the hedonistic butterfly and gadabout, who is constantly in movement without actually getting anywhere. And there's the young Claudio and his very serious and principled sister Isabella. And of course, the irrepressible Baradine, not to mention Duke Vincencio, the man who pulls the strings. And for me, this play contains one of Shakespeare's greatest speeches. I'm referring to that extraordinary speech of Isabella to Angelo in Act Two, which includes the lines, "But man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, most ignorant of what he's most assured, his glassy essence." Ooh. The strutting arrogance conferred by a little brief authority. How many politicians could we apply those lines to today? It's an absolute humdinger of a speech. We'll come back to it later. We have asked Kyla Nelson to record it for us. Actually, there is another line from this play which has stuck with me ever since I first read it 40 years ago. It's a line which I believe is key to understanding this strange drama. It comes in Act Four, when Lucio threads his way along a corridor in the prison and comes upon Isabella and the Duke. The Duke, of course, disguised as the friar. Lucio has heard that Claudio has been executed, and he tells Isabella how sorry he is. And he says, "But they say the Duke will be here tomorrow. By my troth, Isabella, I loved thy brother. If the old fantastical Duke of Dark Corners had been at home, he had lived." Now, this phrase, "the old fantastical Duke of Dark Corners," does not please the person it is describing, who is present in disguise. But what a tremendously insightful and telling line it is, both in relation to the character of the Duke and also to what we might call the topography of this play, where desires are both on the one hand repressed and indeed violently repressed, and on the other, flamboyantly and shockingly expressed, and where self-knowledge eludes the grasp of all three leading characters. There is a moment in Act Three where the Duke, disguised as the friar, asks Aeschylus what the Duke was like, and Aeschylus replies that the Duke was a person who, above all other strifes, contended especially to know himself. Well, contended, no doubt, but did he succeed? For something like 15 years, the Duke appears to have taken only a passing interest in what was happening inside his city. Now he's panicked at the idea that quite a thwart goes all decorum. And what has he done? He has popped Angelo into the hot seat while he exits stage left. What was the Duke doing during those 15 years? Dabbling in foreign policy, perhaps? Because war is clearly a backdrop to this play. More importantly, what we are given to understand is that the Duke loved the life removed, i.e. some kind of retirement, no doubt filled with books and study and reflection. This Duke appears to be a man without family and without friends. Was he some kind of hermit scholar? Did he only drop in on council meetings from time to time? And what was the fruit of all this removed reflection? Well, I guess we could argue that he has a better grasp of human failings than Angelo, and I guess he has a shrewder grasp of political realities because he sees the advantage in not having his name associated with the reign of terror that he suspects Angelo's promotion is likely to cause. This is one of the teasing ambiguities of the play. To what extent did the Duke anticipate Angelo's strict and merciless application of the law? In his very first speech in the play, the Duke asks Aeschylus for his opinion of Angelo. Apparently it's an innocent question, and Aeschylus replies that Angelo is absolutely worthy of the honour being conferred on him. Indeed, he is the most worthy in Vienna. Then when Angelo appears, the Duke says, "Angelo, there is a kind of character in thy life that to the observer doth thy history fully unfold." Ambiguous. This suggests on the one hand that there is a perfect concordance between Angelo's character and his life to date, but it also leaves open the possibility that Angelo's story, now that he has been given full power, may take a rapid turn for the worse. When we next see the Duke speaking to Friar Thomas, he uses the word seemer in connection with Angelo and scorns him, saying that Angelo is a man who scarce confesses that his blood flows. In other words, that he denies all his natural human instincts. And later we learn that the Duke has known literally for years about Angelo's shoddy and heartless treatment of Mariana. In one sense, the Duke is clearly setting Angelo up to fail. Now, this is a play, and directors and actors bring their own lights to it. How are those first lines of the Duke to Angelo spoken? In the Royal Shakespeare production of the play from 2019, which I will speak more of in the second episode, Anthony Byrne played the Duke, and he said the lines like this. "Angelo! There is a kind of character in thy life that to the observer doth thy history fully unfold." Now, when that's said that way, that changes things, doesn't it? What I'm trying to get at here is both the richness of the interpretations out there by leading theatrical companies, and also the fact that there are so many dark corners in these characters and in this drama. The action of Measure for Measure takes place mainly at night, and there are a number of scenes in prison. As we edge our way down the dank corridors of the jail where Claudio is being held, there are deep pockets and wells of shadow, and Barnardine can be heard shouting in the distance, banging his dinner plate, calling out for drink. "A pox on your throat! Who makes that noise there? What are you? Away, you rogue! Away! I'm sleepy." There is shadow and darkness too in the personalities who appear before us. Take Isabella. When she speaks of sex, the verb she uses is abhor. Abhor is a really strong verb, and it's a scared kind of verb. It's a verb that expresses an instinctive recoil. She abhors the vice of lechery. Indeed, the whole notion of sex and sexual penetration appears to frighten her. She's a woman who, in entering a nunnery, seeks a more strict restraint. Like Angelo, she believes that a strict restraint is the only way of guarding against warping. This is another verb that reverberates through the play, even if the word is only used twice. The Duke gives Angelo and Aeschylus a commission from which he says he would not have them warp. And further on, when Claudio begs his sisters to spare his life, she calls him a warped slip of wilderness. These are people who are in the grip of an ideology that is very quick to judge others. In this, Angelo, who represses all natural human instincts, there are quite clearly dark, unexplored corners. And of course, there are dark corners in this fantastical Duke with his guardedness, his awkwardness, his penchant for dissimulation, but most of all in this apparent inability to empathize in any genuine way with another human being. But let's wind back a little and ask, where does Measure for Measure fit in the Shakespearean chronology? Well, first of all, it's a Jacobean play. In other words, one of the plays written during the period when King James was King of England. Shakespeare wrote a dozen plays in his Jacobean period, but this play, Measure for Measure, is his very first Jacobean play. It was written in 1603-1604. And those who were schooled in the dates of the English kings will remember that Queen Elizabeth I died in 1603, and James, who had already been King of Scotland for more than 20 years, came down from Edinburgh to London and ascended to the English throne, yoking together two independent sovereign nations. Did King James ever meet Shakespeare? Quite likely, since Shakespeare's troupe performed many times in front of him. And then there's James's fondness for literature to consider. A few months after becoming King of England, James became the official sponsor of Shakespeare's theatre group, who became the King's Men. Obviously, a major honour, and it was therefore only natural that Shakespeare should take an interest in this new and eminent sponsor. where to start? Well, James was already the author of several books, including a book on poetry. This new king thought of himself as a scholar. And here, as we start to explore the links between King James and Shakespeare's character, Duke Vincentio, think of that line in Measure for Measure when the Duke protests to Lucio that the absent Duke should be considered not just a statesman and a soldier, but a scholar. There are many links between Duke Vincentio, this fantastical Duke of Dark Corners, and the new king. Consider the following. One of the books that King James wrote is a treatise on government in which he counsels his son about how to be a good king. Now, of course, at the end of Act 3 of Measure for Measure, there's a speech with the Duke alone on stage that begins, "He who the sword of heaven will bear should be as holy as severe." And it goes on, patterning out instructions on kingship, similar to the lessons in King James's book. For me, this is Shakespeare writing with a particular audience member in mind. Now, in a previous cover-to-cover episode, we talked about the historical background to Shakespeare's Macbeth, another Jacobean play written in 1606, a couple of years after Measure for Measure, and in the aftermath of the famous gunpowder plot, that attempt by Catholic dissenters to blow up the Houses of Parliament. When the gunpowder plotters were brought to trial, King James and his wife and son were actually present in court, although they were not visible. They were hidden away from public gaze behind a screen. James was anxious to gauge what was going on in his new kingdom. He wanted to measure the dangers, to gauge the threats, to once again use words that Shakespeare puts in the mouth of Duke Vincentio. James thought of himself as the kind of man who could use his brain to defeat evil. As the Duke says, "Craft against vice I must apply." But there are loads of other connections and links. Like Duke Vincentio, King James was not a fan of crowds. He did not enjoy the people's loud applause, their aves vehement. He preferred dark corners to the blaze of the spotlight. He preferred the life removed. Again, like Shakespeare himself, King James was almost certainly bisexual. And in Measure for Measure, the Duke says of himself in his friar disguise, "I never heard the absent Duke much detected for women. He was not inclined that way." Clearly, Shakespeare thumbed through James's published works in order to understand who he was dealing with, who this new sponsor was. And he went on to draw a character based on James himself. James had written that when he first became King of Scotland, he had been too lenient, and that leniency had been a mistake. In the words of the play, "Mercy is not itself that oft looks so. Pardon is still the nurse of second woe." Measure for Measure starts with a situation in which quite a thought goes all decorum. A severe corrective is required, and this sets up the dramatic tension. Where does severity tip into tyranny? A key theme in the play is this relationship between justice and mercy, and the need for the ruler to find a middle way, to be able to show necessary severity without ignoring Christian forgiveness. And that indeed is the trajectory of Duke Vincencio, whose 15 or 20 year laxity is corrected when he comes back all powerful at the end of the play to both dispense justice and show mercy. Consider another interesting historical fact that ties the personality of the new monarch to the Duke of the play. King James absolutely loathed slander. In 1585, as King of Scotland, he passed a law that made slander of the king a treasonable offence punishable by death. And indeed, the historians tell us that several people were executed under this law. In one of his books, King James writes, "But unto one fault is all the common people of this kingdom subject, as well burgh as land," in other words, as much city folk as country folk, "which is to judge and speak rashly of their prince." King James could not tolerate people who spoke rashly of their prince. And indeed, the Duke Vincencio of the play is obsessed with slander and incensed by the loose-tongued Lucio. Witty, winking, outrageous slander is the essential dynamic between them. And at the end of the play, when the Duke berates Lucio, in one sense, the audience is with the Duke because they see before their eyes Lucio shamelessly repudiating his previous utterances and endeavouring to pin them to the robe of the absent friar. It's funny. But in another sense, the audience is discomforted by the intensity of the Duke's spite. Referring to Lucio, the Duke says, "And yet here's one in place I cannot pardon." The Duke is livid. Initially, at least, he wants to have Lucio put to death. Well, I hope I have established to your satisfaction that in one sense this play is a portrait of the new king, King James. But of course, in the shape, in the action, in the character of Duke Vincencio, Shakespeare goes far beyond flattering imitation. Let's pick up the story in the next episode.